Mrajuhtuden.
Mrajuhtuden.
Sober as sober. Sober. Sober as
welcome to the Anonymous Eskimo Project, a program devoted to bringing hope to those struggling with mental health issues and addiction. Through candid conversations with guests about mental health issues, addiction, and sobriety, we can let those who are struggling know that they are not alone. I am your host, Ralph Sara. On this show, I have Robert Kinneen. Rob is Tlingit from Southeast Alaska. He was born in Petersburg, Alaska, and grew up in Anchorage, Alaska. Rob is a chef who has appeared on the Today Show with Al Roker, and also was selected to cook a 5-course meal for President Barack Obama. Rob is the author of his own cookbook called Fresh Alaska Cookbook. Currently, Rob is the Outreach Director for Natives, or the North American Traditional Indigenous Food Systems, which is a nonprofit that is dedicated to addressing the economic and health crisis affecting Native communities by reestablishing Native foodways. Rob has been living alcohol-free for 3 years, and on this show, Rob shares his story for those who are curious about living alcohol-free. So guys, please help me welcome Robert Kinneen. Okay, hi Rob, how are you?
Doing fantastic, thanks.
And where are you?
I reside in Durham, North Carolina.
So Rob, can you go ahead and introduce yourself and let everybody know who you are?
Sure. My name is Rob Kinneen. I am Tlingit from Southeast Alaska. So I was born in Petersburg, and I'm a part of the Eagle Moiety and the Killer Whale clan from the village of Sitkakwan. My grandfather's family is from Sitka, Alaska, and then I'm also of Irish heritage as well. I went to culinary school in New York. I went to the Culinary Institute of America and worked in restaurants from then. I lived in New Orleans, did some work in Durham, North Carolina, back to Alaska for about 15 years. We moved back to Durham in 2016, and we've been here since.
Wow. And you're the outreach director for Natives.
I reached out to a nonprofit called Natives, North American Traditional Indigenous Food Systems. Co-founders are Sean Sherman and Dana Thompson. I had heard that they were doing this kind of work, and they were kind of like, well, we're trying to do this kind of work. And then that kind of turned into a job interview. So for the past 10 months, I've been the outreach director for Natives.
Can you kind of let us know, you know, your path to deciding to be alcohol free and, you know, living your life like that now?
It was one of those things where I think it's an unfortunate situation with the service industry where that becomes your payment. When I was getting a little older, I'm like, you know, I'd rather just have the 10 extra dollars and go home, you know? Probably just say the majority of my life, I was probably a healthy drinker and probably more than moderate. And a lot of that was kind of, you know, I don't like to dwell on it. I don't like to say, oh, if I only would have, you know, stopped drinking when I was 30 instead of 45 or something like that. But I will say that whenever I questioned it, I guess I could always look back and be like, you know what? I don't have DUIs. I'm still married. My daughter knows who I am. Like, you know, there's these things that aren't like benchmarks where it's like, oh, I lost my job again because I was drunk the day after payday or whatever, you know? And so whenever I kind of questioned myself, and I did a lot, I'm 48. So when I was like 40, I noticed like my metabolism slowing down a little bit. I noticed things affecting me a little more. And when I was 45, but between those ages, I guess the one thing that happened, I had a very dear friend of mine pass away. And I was at that point a pretty heavy drinker. When we moved to North Carolina, I would just say like the macroeconomics of the state and just like, you know, without getting into it, like I would say the universe was telling me I need to get out of Alaska. Anything I was trying to do was just like, it just seemed harder than it needed to be. And so we moved here and I was probably a little depressed. And, you know, anytime you move, you also, you know, money is an issue because you move. you know, I didn't have enough money to go do anything extra, but I always had enough money to get a six pack of beer or a bottle of wine. And I just found myself getting, you know, a little heavier and just kind of a slippery slope where it's like, oh, I just got to, you know, drink a little more coffee in the morning to get up and do my day. And then I got to, you know, drink a little more wine to relax from all the coffee. And then I got to, you know, I'm achy from this and that. Yeah, I just kind of, it just started getting to be a lot. And, you know, and when I started thinking about it, it was like, this isn't fun. But probably the first bout with sobriety for me was I had a very dear friend pass away, and it was alcohol related.
Mm.
And I knew that if I drank alcohol through that, it wouldn't be good. And I just something in my mind was like, just don't do that, you know? So it was probably 6 months, and then, you know, I was kind of like, oh, maybe I should, you know, maybe I'll just drink on a Friday. Maybe I'll just drink on the weekend, you know? And just, it seemed like I started, you know, I had a glass of wine or a beer or something. And then, you know, within the week I was drinking just like I was before, you know, it was just right back to the habits. I'd slow down here and there. About a year later, I think I was sober for 3 months. And I just kind of did the same thing. I just stopped. I was working with this guy that was not drinking at the time. And, you know, we just kind of talked about it, and it just seemed like a good idea. So I did. And that was about 3 months. The last time, it was December of like 2019. I just, you know, and I guess for me, it was one of those things where, like, again, like, you know, if I ever thought about like Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm like, I don't have those kinds of stories. I don't have those kinds of experiences.
Mm-hmm.
But I do feel that if I got active, that would help, you know, quell some of those issues that would encourage me to drink. I started kind of going back to a gym again, doing some things. Like, just every day I would get up, I'm like, you know what? I'm not going to drink today. An old chef friend would pour me a glass of wine. I'm like, ah, what the hell, you know, maybe tomorrow. And not that I would get like blotto or out of it, but it was just the idea that I just kind of was sort of done with it. And so again, like going into the holidays, my sister and her family were coming to visit. I don't know what I'm going to do, but I'm just going to, you know, I had a family member that sort of approached it one time, like, I'm just going to take a break and see what happens. So it wasn't this like proclamation of like sobriety and like, you know, this big thing. It was just like, I'm going to take a break. So I just thought, you know, through the holidays, and it's one of those things where like, I don't want to tell my sister I'm not drinking or tell anybody I'm not drinking, but I just wanted to enjoy the holidays. And so my wife's birthday is December 31st. You know, we were down in South Carolina. We had a, you know, split two bottles of wine between four adults. The next day, you know, we were having dinner. It's like, hey, you want some wine? I'm like, I'm good, you know, and I didn't drink for the rest of the week. Yeah. And then I was like, at that point, I'm like, is it dry January? Is it 6 months until my birthday? Is it a year? And I was like, you know what? I'm not going to put that kind of pressure on anything. I'm just going to say, I'm not doing it, you know? And that's kind of just where it is. My wife, she found out I wasn't drinking because she's like, in February, she's like, I was wondering why the wine was always going bad, you know, because I wasn't there to like finish it off. It's like, oh, it's open. I might as well just, you know, kill the bottle. Yeah. So that's kind of where it started for me and how it worked. And yeah, I guess that's about it.
Yeah. When I have people on, I always have that vision in my mind that something had to happen, some kind of trauma or some kind of bad thing that happened in their lives that made them drink so much. Kind of like my story, you know, that's my story. But I love to hear people that just decided for their health and for their family and stuff like that to just do it. It was super hard for me. For you, was it difficult to just stop, or did you have to like work through some things, or, you know, change your life a little bit, or was it difficult?
I think I think life changed for everybody because it was January 2020. So by March, nobody was going out. Nobody was doing anything. And then March, I got a chance to go to Utqiagvik, Alaska for this contract work. Like, airports were always like, oh man, I'm going to go early and get to Anchorage, to the airport in Anchorage. And I'm like, I can't think of the name of the place now. It's a pizza joint in Fairbanks, Silver Gulch. And it's like, I'm going to go to Silver Gulch, I'm going to get a pizza and two beers, and then I'm going to get on the plane. And when I'm in Seattle, I'll go to Vino Volo and get a glass of wine and a charcuterie plate. A couple of months prior to that, I was concentrating on my health because, again, like, too many carbohydrates and beer, so I'll drink wine. Well, wine is just fruit, which means it's sugar, right? And carbohydrates transition to sugar, which is turns into fat. And so at that point, I was pre-diabetic. I was I had hypertension, and I've always been like relatively moderately fit, is what I'd say. I never had to where, you know, again, it wasn't like an ultimatum in my personal life. It wasn't anything else. It's just like, I kind of was just tired of feeling like garbage. And I think that it was, so, for me, I felt super empowered because I went there. And at that point, I was eating like a more of a keto diet. I had lost a lot of weight because what I was eating inadvertently was hurting myself. I was eating a lot of, you know, nuts and a lot of things that were just adding sugar and fuel and kind of just engorging my body a lot. So that was one step. I stopped drinking and that was a big step. When I, you know, my nervousness was like going out into the world. So I'm going to these places where I'm like, oh, I kill my time by having a beer or two at the airport, right? And I was like, man, I'm really proud of myself. I just did this and I had my own snacks because there's nothing nutritionally redeemable if you go to an airport. And then, you know, I was like, I think I can really make a go of this. And then the world kind of shut down and then, you know, we didn't have anything to worry about. Like I said, it would be as simple as like, I'm not going to drink today. And then someone's like, hey, I just bought you a beer. I'm like, oh crap. Well, I guess I'll start tomorrow. Whereas now I can say, I'm okay. I don't need that beer. Sorry you paid for it, but I'm not drinking it one way or another. Those were the small empowering moments that I needed. And again, it wasn't the idea. I think it was this weird thing where I have a value in my mind of what a drink is worth to me. And it's just zeroed out. And now it's like, it doesn't, that kind of stuff is just like no value to me. There is just of no value. I have two friends and one's been sober for like 5 years and she just decided to quit. And her husband has been sober for like 10 or 11. And he, you know, he still is AA two times a day sometimes, you know? So I just feel super fortunate that that gene passed me by because I'm Irish and Alaska Native. I mean, I'm kind of built to be a train wreck in a lot of ways. And so I'm super grateful and I'm recognizing that aspect that, you know, I didn't need that kind of support. But that said, it was also hard because I don't feel like there's that support for me. There's not that support of like, hey, what if you just don't want to freaking drink tonight? You know, and I think that's changing a lot now, or at least I'm seeing it change a little bit. But that was the interesting part for me, was like having it take so long because I can look and just say, well, if I write, you know, if I make a pro and con list, like I'm not necessarily like in dire straits. I'm not like, it's not of the utmost urgency to change my life or I will die, you know? And I feel like that's when you go to AA or something, it's like, I need to make a change. I need to really do something about this. So I do feel very fortunate that that this was figured out in this way, but also it would be nice to like, what I kind of hope to do with this is I call it normalizing sobriety. Like, you know, you don't have to go out and just get, you know, get lit. You don't have to go out and do this. Like, and I think just like normalize being alcohol free to me would be a really nice thing to kind of advocate for.
When I think of the food industry, you see these things on TV, all these shows. And I am a big fan of Anthony Bourdain. You know, he had that Kitchen Confidential and about the whole drinking culture and, you know, drug culture of people in the service industry. And that was a big thing in my head that I would think about. And that's how I thought it was. And hearing you talk about you being the person that maybe would have a beer or something like that, but didn't go down that path like other people do. It's kind of normalizing, you know, in these shows and in these books about having problems with alcohol or drugs and stuff like that.
Yeah, I think, I mean, the interesting part about that book, and I think it's that, you know, when Anthony Bourdain wrote it, I mean, if you look at it, it was written talking about all the debauchery that he had seen and done. And stuff. And I think he still drank, obviously, but like I have hired felons. I've hired people that are like, have been in the system. And it's kind of one of those things where it's like, it is kind of like that to an extreme, not an extreme example. I'm sure there are extreme examples, but I can say like, it is that pirate ship, you know, I mean, it is that debauchery and that craziness. And there is an aspect in the service industry. And again, the other encourageable side is like, you know, if you were an accountant or you worked at a shoe store, it wouldn't be like, oh, hey, get a free pair of shoes for you on your way out. Like you don't help yourself to the register if you work at a bank. It's a thing to me. It's one of the issues I have with the service industry is the antiquated system of tipping right now, where gratuities go to the front of house. Whereas, like, you know, I think everybody should be able to make a wage. And I think, you know, and I'm including the people that own the restaurants, you know, there's a lot of stuff that's antiquated with the system. And that's kind of a relief to be out of it. Part of it is the fact that it just encourages that. Like I said, it's like, oh, well, if you can't get a dollar more an hour raise, like you can always get a shift beer. And those are the kinds of things for me that are a little rough. But again, it's like sometimes it's like, you know, a group of people that maybe for whatever reason have some baggage or trauma, and then they're put in a position where it's like, oh, well, this is acceptable. Whereas like if I was working at a bank, it wouldn't be acceptable to go out and have a couple of beers on my lunch hour and come back or drink before work or drink, get blotto after work or whatever. So it is interesting, but I think that there's that hopefully that changes a little bit. And I feel like with the pandemic and the aftermath of people thinking about work and thinking about, you know, right now it's like if you were to be a cook in this industry, like you have to have two jobs to survive. It's like, well, that's, you know, unemployment's low because everybody's working two jobs. But the other side is that, you know, if you look at that and think like my life is going to be working two jobs and that's how I'm going to like not even prosper, but just make ends meet, like that's not okay. So it's interesting. I think also like I always kind of like to go back and explain that, you know, a lot of the work when we're talking about this, I always like to say alcohol free and not sober or working on sobriety, because just because of that too, like when you say I'm sober or I'm living, you know, a life of sobriety. So I just choose to say alcohol free because yeah. I am just kind of living in a sense. Like I have a value and it's important to me, but it's also not like I'm not reporting to anything more than just myself and who I am. And just like I was kind of explaining before, it's like it's important to me. And I'm definitely saying it's changed my life for the positive. And there's really, I can't imagine a time where I'm going to be thinking a drink is going to be worth, you know, not being alcohol free. But it just, for me, it just kind of creates a more regular feel about it in that respect.
Yeah, definitely. You were talking about Uktiarvik, and I saw you went to Bethel. That's where I'm from.
Yeah, I've been to Bethel a couple times.
Made, what was it, salsa, smelt, or something like that?
You've done your homework, man. And so I went to this culture camp. So we went, the first time I went to Bethel, we flew in, got on a boat, went up the YK, and we went to this culture camp. So the kind of funny part was they're like, what do you want to cook? And I'm like, I don't know, what do you got? And so they're like, we have ducks. I'm like, great, I'll do duck. And like, we might get a salmon. Hey, that sounds great. And then we'll have some smelt. I'm like, awesome. So like they show up and they literally like have ducks in it, like frozen ducks in the round, which means there's guts and everything, feathers. And you know, it's like 10 in the morning. And they're like, oh, we'll put them out and defrost them. I'm like, oh, this just got real, you know, like I'm plucking duck feathers on a half cooked, a half frozen duck. So I made like a duck soup. And then with a smelt, we just took them and I kind of pan seared them and we did them like that. And then I chopped some and I kind of just made like a salsa. So it was like corn, tomatoes, black beans, and then like corn chips. And again, when I cook with traditional foods, I try to kind of, especially in certain, I mean, I think about if you go up into the north and southwest, like they're dry areas, which means they don't have alcohol. And so I really try not to cook with alcohol when I'm using traditional foods. And then I actually also try to do it dairy-free and gluten-free. And that's just my parameters in the sense of like how I handle the food, but also the fact that, you know, if you're doing something with traditional foods and an outreach in that capacity, it's always under a banner of health and wellness, which is diabetes, obesity, and cancer concerns. And so, you know, dairy, gluten, and, you know, kind of fattier foods are an issue. I mean, obviously not fat like whale fat or omega-3 fatty acids in salmon, but just like extra super fatty foods. So that's kind of what I try to do. And then that also usually turns into something fun. Again, you're out in the woods, you have a fire, a frozen duck, and a piece of fish that just got pulled out of the YK. Like, I don't know, it's kind of rad.
That's so cool. That's something that I would never even think about. You know, I have a friend, Don, we used to joke about, hey, we're going to do a cook, like a, you know, Costco Cream cookbook or a native cookbook. And it would be whatever you had, fish, you know, chicken, whatever, put it in a pot, boil. Because growing up, that's like what my mom, you know, we had one of those old black and white, you know, cast top stoves, you know, run heating fuel. But we never used it for like, my mom never used it for like cooking or anything like that. It was for heating because our house was like really small. It was like two rooms, right? You know, we had honey buckets and no running water and stuff like that. But that stove, I could remember... she would clean the inside of it with, you know, the soot and everything from all the heating oil. She would clean that out, but she never used it for like cooking. She had like a two burner electric, you know, burner, heating thing on the floor, and she would cook on that. And a lot of the food would be soup. You know, you were mentioning you made a soup. Almost all of like the stuff she would cook, it would be
a soup or a stew of some sort. You know, she'd put like rice in there and some vegetables. We didn't have a lot of fresh veggies or anything. When I grew up, it was a lot of canned food, you know, from the store or native food. So we would joke around, Don and I, we're going to do a cookbook where it was like put everything in a pot, boil, and then put some salt on it.
Yeah.
You know?
And if you're getting bougie with it, you're throwing some Tabasco on there or something, right?
Yeah. You have a cookbook.
I do. Yeah, Fresh Alaska cookbook. Yep. I think 2018, 2019 that was released.
Cool. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. It was just, you know, I always kind of joke and I say the next book I'm going to write is how not to write a book with that. But I think that I am proud of it. It was interesting because I like wrote it and then I was like finishing it and then I moved. So I like released a cookbook about Alaska food, but I lived in North Carolina. So like promoting it was kind of weird. I think the big deep dive in it, again, like kind of going back to some of the foods, like growing up in Petersburg in Southeast, I have, you know, very vivid memories of clam digging with my uncles. And I remember, you know, my uncles hunting and there was always just food bartering going on. You know, one uncle's throwing smoked salmon this way, we're giving out something that way. And so that was kind of a big memory for me. When I went to culinary school and traveled, I moved down to New Orleans. And part of it is because of the fact that it was New Orleans and I was, you know, young and 20. And the other part was because I can't think of another city in the world where it's got a certain type of food. But when you talk about New Orleans, it's like a cultural hub of food, a singular cultural identity of food. And that just kind of struck my chord a little bit. And that's something that from there I moved up back home and then I went to North Carolina. And that was more of a farm to table culture. Even though when you're there, there's also a Gullah culture, there's an indigenous culture. When I moved back to Alaska, it was like I was really working on a farm to table culture, but the growing season is 5 months. So when you look at the tradition of growing food in Alaska, it really goes back to like FDR. You know, like the New Deal, bringing people to the Matanuska Valley and the interior of the state. And obviously people had gardens and things like that. It wasn't really, I was doing a video webisode that I got funded for called Fresh Alaska. This one guy was like, you know, hey, we're Alaska. This is a food desert. Like there's no food up here if we don't grow it. 96% of our food is imported. And I'm like, I didn't say it, but I remember just thinking like, dude, we've been here for like thousands of years, right? And the Tlingits and Southeastern indigenous people had it the easiest. Like there's food all over the place all the time. So when you go to Utagavik or Bear or Bethel, or you do these, you know, you look at these places, Nome, and you're like, not only did you have to have the food, but then you had to have the food available like for a broad swath of a season. So that kind of got me thinking about traditional foods. And that's kind of what that book was about. Like, you know, I really kind of talk about contemporary food culture, which is like, I'm a chef at a restaurant and I can't serve moose or whale at this restaurant. I'll get shut down. But the other side of the food culture in Alaska is subsistence. And that's a whole different world and a whole different meal. If you go and eat somebody's house, you know, that's a very different meal. And so it's really kind of bringing light to that. And then a lot of the book was, you know, I did write about like about cooking for President Obama in there. I wrote about a couple of other experiences and a lot of it was focusing on local foods. Then some, you know, so some of it was like reindeer sausage, which is like Indian Valley meats, and like a razor clam pasta. So that's something that's, you know, sausage, clams and pastas, you know, that's not a big crazy thing, but when you individualize it with local ingredients like that and do something, kind of reimagine it in that capacity. I think I have muktuk sushi in there. So that's something, for example, where I partnered with the University of Alaska Fairbanks. And the awesome part was like, they let me write the book that I wanted to, but the bad part was that it was also coming up with funding called Above the Line, which means that I had to come up with it. I do think it shines a light on Alaska and the unique aspect of Alaska.
Very cool. Very cool. Did you ever watch that bizarre show that went to Alaska, that what's his name? I forget his name.
Andrew Zimmern.
Yeah. You ever try any of that food, like, you know, tepuk, which is stink heads from where I'm from, you know, the fermented salmon heads or anything like that?
I haven't gotten that tradish. No, I have not. Oh, okay. And then the innards. And it's just kind of fascinating to me, like when you start looking at, like, again, I recently read Willie Hensley's book again, 50 Miles to Tomorrow. I've really been paying a lot of attention to, I guess, just to my indigenous heritage and the narrative is what I will say. So, you know, the idea that we're like merciless savages and we needed all this self-correcting. And then I was just reading in this book, it's called Indigenous Empire or Indigenous Continent. And it was saying like, they were talking to these people in California And they're like, they spoke like, I mean, I want to say like over 20 languages and had like four different concepts of religion because they were working within like California. So the trade routes were right there. And you're just like, you know, how do you look at that and call that savage? You know, when it's that sophisticated with all the languages and the diversity and the empathy to cultures that you're trading with and working with. And that kind of came to light again when we were talking. I was reading this book with Willie Hensley's book, and he was talking about in Utagavik, in Kotzebue, they were homesteaders, and they would shoot a seal, flip it over, like skin it, pull it out, like, you know, tan the hide, flip it over, sew it up, and it was a poke. So they would take, you know, ducks or fish, and they would ferment it, and they would keep it in the poke, and they would tie it off. And it's like, and so I look at that and I'm like, that's like the furthest thing away from savage. You know what I mean? Like fermenting food, knowing it's good for you, knowing that, I mean, and they're not walking around. I would say it's like, they're not walking around in lab coats, like checking these things, but they know it's going to work and they've got the tradition and the knowledge. And those are the kinds of things, like those are the stories that I kind of keep hearing about over and over again when it talks about traditional foods, or just the idea that, you know, controlled burns of forestry so that, you know, it would, create mushrooms after things, or pull back leaves so that certain things would grow, or it would attract, you know, animals that they could harvest. And it was just like the sophisticated nature of indigenous people is really fascinating. And that's what I think about when I think about stinkheads as well. It's just the idea that, you know, you're taking something that really people throw away, or I mean, you know, you can, again, hey, you can boil the heads. but you know, it's just the way that food was utilized and praised was really, really fascinating.
Yeah, definitely. I'm sorry to say that I didn't try it my whole life. My mom would eat it and I'd have to leave the house. I'm sorry. when you use alcohol for cooking, the alcohol burns off, right?
Yeah. I would, for the most part, I mean, especially like the way, like in savory cooking, like for example, you're gonna, you know, you're pan-searing a piece of meat and you deglaze with like even brandy or, you know, I mean, a liquor or red wine, the majority of the alcohol will deglaze.
What kind of advice would you give somebody that who's maybe kind of like in your shoes, not really having a alcohol problem, but is curious about, you know, living alcohol free?
Probably just say the same thing that was kind of given to me. I mean, again, a family member of mine, you know, he's like, yeah, man, I just decided to take a break. And that break lasted 2 years. And now I drink once a year. And every year I drink. And, you know, so he doesn't identify himself as again, like, I hate to put myself as like alcohol. I probably will say I'm alcohol free. But I hate to say for 3 years and then slip up. And now it's like, you know, my identity is attached to that. And I think that's kind of a thing that makes me a little nervous about some of this. But what I would say is probably one of the biggest things is also like, I feel like sometimes health and wellness is tied up into this. So, you know, if alcohol free is something you're interested in, find something to do in those times that you would normally decompress and drink.
Well, Rob, I want to thank you so much for coming on here and telling your story and your perspective. It's different than a lot of my other ones, but that's what I like about this show. You know, I have everybody that's, you know, either like you say, alcohol free, or, you know, somebody that's just sober or something. So I really, really want to thank you so much. Where can people find you on like social media outlets, or, you know, your webpage and stuff like that?
Yeah, well, so I have my book, Fresh Alaska by Rob Kinnean. I have a website, www.kinnean.com. Other than that, I'm on social media and I kind of just work off Instagram for the most part. So ROB_ or whatever that, you know, underline, and then KINNEEN, www.natifs.org.
Well, that's all for today's show. I hope you, the listeners, found some inspiration, strength, and hope. Listen next week when I have another strong, courageous person on who's walking with us on this healing journey. This program is available as a podcast. You can hear this and many more episodes wherever you listen to podcasts, or at anonymouseskimo.com. Join in the Anonymous Eskimo Project, Saturdays at 3 p.m., Sundays at 8 p.m. on KSKO, serving the western interior of Alaska for more than four decades. I'm your host, Ralph Sara. Biura!